Chapter 39. For the 5 hours of remaining darkness, Pitt spun the truck's wheels through the awesome wilderness of sand where time had little meaning. This was truly a land of no compromise that chilled with its cold mornings, choked with its fine sand, and baked with a sun that seemed magnified by a crystal atmosphere. He felt as if he had entered a world not of his universe. They were moving through a section of the Sahara called the Tanasruft, huge, sprawling badlands with almost 200,000 square kilometers of bleak, grotesque wasteland, broken only by a few rugged escarpments, and an occasional sea of sand dunes that relentlessly moved across the flats like ghostly armies of veiled phantoms. This was the desert primeval without a weed in sight. And yet there was life. Moths fluttered about the headlights. A pair of ravens, the desert's scavenging cleaning service, disturbed by the annoyance of the truck, took wing and squawked in annoyance. Large black scarabs scampered over the sand to escape the tires, as did an occasional scorpion and tiny green lizard. Pitt found it easy to become intimidated by the surrounding void, by the hundreds of kilometers they had yet to travel, the almost certain hunger, thirst, and privations that remained to be endured. His only solace was the steady roar of the Renault's engine. It hadn't skipped a beat since leaving the mines, and the four-wheel drive performed flawlessly, surging through soft spots Pitt was sure would bog them down. On four occasions he was forced to drive into deep, narrow, dry washes with sloping soft gravel banks, barely making it up and over the opposite edge in low gear. Often he found no way to dodge sudden drop-offs or boulders and having to risk going over seemingly impossible barriers, but somehow the sturdy Renault pulled them through. They took no time to stop, get out, and stretch their legs. They would get enough of walking later when they abandoned the truck. They even took calls of nature on the fly without braking. "How far have we traveled?" asked Giordino. Pitt glanced at the odometer. 102 kilometers. Giordino looked at him. "You take the wrong shortcut, or are we going in circles? We should have covered almost 200 kilometers by now. Are we lost?" "We're on course," said Pitt confidently. "Blame it on Fairweather's directions. He gave distances as the crow flies. No crow with half a brain would be flying around the desert if he could be attacking a scarecrow in an Iowa cornfield. Impossible to maintain a straight line when we've already had to detour 40 kilometers to avoid two deep ravines and a herd of sand dunes." Giordino stirred uncomfortably. "Why do I get a sinking feeling we're about to hike a lot further than 100 kilometers across no man's land?" "Not a cheery thought," Pitt agreed. "Be light soon. We'll lose the stars to navigate by." "Don't need them. I finally figured how to build a do-it-yourself compass straight out of the Army Field Manual." "Glad to hear it," Giordino yawned. "What does the fuel gauge read?" "Slightly over half a tank left." Giordino turned and looked back at the Tuareg they had tied up in the truck bed. "Our friend looks about as happy as a Shanghaied sailor." "He doesn't know it yet, but he's our ticket to evade pursuit," answered Pitt. "The devious mind again, it never stops churning." Pitt briefly stared up at the sickle moon. He would have preferred a full phase, but he was thankful for what little light it sent down as he drove the truck across a terrain equal to a lunar landscape. He shifted gears and strained his eyes on the uneven ground revealed by the headlights. Then suddenly the desert smoothed out and began to sparkle like fireworks. The Renault rolled onto a huge dry lake with crystal deposits that reflected the twin beams from the headlights like prisms in rainbow colors. Pitt opened the Renault up in high gear and felt exhilarated to be speeding over a firm, flat surface at nearly 90 kilometers an hour. The desert floor seemed to reach into infinity, the early morning stars falling below the horizon line as if the great brink of a flat world abruptly fell away into space. The sky looked as if it was closing in all around them, like the four walls and ceiling of a small room. An unnerving sense of disorientation gripped Pitt. Yet he was following nearly the same parallel as Havana, Cuba, so the Big Dipper was still above the horizon. He continually used Polaris as a base point to line up a star to the east and then steered toward it. Hour passed upon monotonous hour as the crystal lake gave way to low, boulder-strewn hills. Pitt could not recall having experienced such a heavy shroud of monotony. His only respite was a small peak off his left to the north that rose like an island in the middle of a vast and sterile sea. Giordino took over the driving chore as the sun burst from the horizon as if shot from a cannon. There it seemed to hang without moving throughout the day until suddenly falling like a rock shortly before sunset. Shadows stretched far into the distance or did not exist. There was no in-between. An hour after daylight, Pitt stopped the truck and searched around the cargo bed until he found a loose pipe about a meter in length. Then he stepped to the ground and pushed the pipe into the sand until it stood vertical and cast a shadow. Picking up two small stones, he placed one at the tip of the shadow. "Is this your poor man's compass?" asked Giordino, studying Pitt's actions from the shade of the truck. "Observe the master at work." He joined Giordino and waited approximately 12 minutes before marking the distance the shadow had traveled with another stone. Next, he drew a straight line from the first stone to the second and extended it about half a meter beyond. He then stood with the toe of his left foot at the first rock and toe of his right where the line ended. Lifting his left arm and pointing straight ahead, he said, "That's north." Then he extended his right arm to the side. "East to the Trans-Saharan track." Giordino sighted down Pitt's outstretched right arm and hand. "I see a dune in that direction we can use as a reference point." They moved on, repeating the process every hour. At about 9 o'clock, the wind began to blow from the southeast, swirling the sand in clouds that cut visibility to less than 200 meters. By 10, the heated wind had increased and was seeping into the cab of the truck despite the rolled-up windows. Swept up in small gusts, the sand rose and twisted like whirling dervishes. The mercury jumped and fell like a pogo stick. This day the temperature rose from 15 degrees centigrade, 60 degrees Fahrenheit, to 35 degrees centigrade, 95 degrees Fahrenheit in 3 hours, topping off during the hottest part of the afternoon at 46 degrees centigrade, 114 degrees Fahrenheit. Pitt and Giordino felt as if they were driving into a furnace, the air hot and dry in their nostrils as they breathed in and exhaled. Their only relief came from the breeze generated by their speed over the stripped and barren land. The needle on the temperature gauge wavered and hung a millimeter off the red boiling mark, but the radiator showed no sign of leaking steam. They stopped every half hour now, as Pitt sighted direction from what little sun shone through the dust cloud and allowed the pipe to cast a faint shadow. He opened one of the canisters of water and offered it to Giordino. "Liquid refreshment time." "How much?" asked Giordino. "We'll split it. That will give us half a liter each, with one in reserve for tomorrow." Giordino steered with his knees as he gauged his share of the water and then drank. He passed the canister back to Pitt. "O'Banion must have set his dogs on the trail by now. Driving the same make and model truck, they won't close the gap unless they've got a Formula One Grand Prix champion driver at the wheel. Their only advantage is having extra fuel on board to continue the chase after we've run dry. Why didn't we think of loading on reserves?" "There were no gas storage drums around the truck parking area. I looked. They must have stored them elsewhere, and we didn't have time to spare for a search." "O'Banion just might whistle up a whirlybird," Giordino said as he downshifted to crawl over a low dune. "Fort Fourreau and the Malian military are his only sources for a helicopter, and my guess is the last people he'll call on for help are Kazim and Massard. He knows damn well they wouldn't look kindly on his losing Public Enemies 1 and 2 only a few hours after we were placed in his tender and loving care." "You don't think O'Banion's posse can hunt us down before we cross into Algeria?" "They can't follow us through a sandstorm any more than a Mountie can track his man through a blizzard." Pitt tilted a thumb over his shoulder out the rear window. "No tracks." Giordino looked into a side-view mirror and saw the wind sweep the sand over the tire tracks as if the truck was a small boat on a vast sea that closed over its wake. He relaxed and slouched in his seat. "You don't know what a pleasure it is to travel with a Pollyanna. Don't write off O'Banion just yet. If they reach the Trans-Saharan track first and patrol back and forth until we appear, the show is over." Pitt finished off the canister and tossed it in the back with the Tuareg guard, who had become conscious and was sitting with his back against the tailgate of the truck, glaring at the men inside the cab. "How's the gas?" Pitt asked. "Almost on fumes." "Time to throw out a red herring. Bring the truck around on a reverse heading toward the west, then come to a stop." Giordino dutifully did what he was ordered, twisted the wheel, and braked to a halt. Now we walk? Now we walk. But first bring the guard up front and check the truck for any item that might prove useful, like cloth to wrap our heads to prevent sunstroke. A strange combination of fear and menace burned in the guard's eyes as they propped him in the front seat, cut strips from his robe and headdress, and then bound him tightly so his hands and feet could not touch the steering wheel or floor pedals. They foraged through the truck, finding a few oily rags and two wash towels that they fashioned into turbans. The guns were left behind, buried in the sand. Then Pitt tied the steering wheel so it couldn't turn and shifted the truck into second gear and jumped from the cab. The faithful Renault lurched forward, carrying its trussed-up passenger, and bounced back toward Tabeza until it became lost in the blowing sand. "You're giving him a better chance to live than he'd have given us," Giordino protested. "Maybe, maybe not," Pitt said mildly. "How far do you figure we have to hike?" "About 180 kilometers," Pitt answered as if it was a short jaunt. "That's almost 112 miles on 1 liter of water that wouldn't grow cactus," Giordino complained. He stared critically into the turbulent wind-blown sand. "I just know my poor old tired bones are going to bleach in the sand." "Look on the bright side," said Pitt, tucking in his crude turban. "You can breathe the pure open air, bask in the silence, commune with nature. No smog, no traffic, no crowds. What can be more invigorating for the soul?" "A bottle of cold beer, a hamburger, and a bath," Giordino sighed. Pitt held up four fingers. 4 days and you'll get your wish." "How are you at desert survival?" Giordino asked hopefully. "I went on a weekend camping trip with the Boy Scouts in the Mojave Desert when I was 12. Giordino shook his head sadly. "That certainly eases all thoughts of anxiety." Pitt took another direction reading. Then, using his compass pipe for a staff, he bent his head against the wind and sand and began walking toward what he determined was east. Giordino hooked a hand in Pitt's belt so they wouldn't lose each other in a sudden blinding wall of sand, and trudged along behind.